with our leadership. We can't be satisfied with where we are. We are going to embrace and welcome, you know, innovation and best practices. We're going to put significant value on our relationships and building healthy, positive and meaningful relationships, not just with our kids, but with our stakeholders as well. And really empowering our leadership team for whatever reason, folks just operated really with this sense of maybe just uncomfortableness. I don't know if it was fear, but they just, I mean, I have heard from so many leaders in the facility that they just were not empowered to do their work. So it has been 90 days and it will be continued where I just have to continue to remind them that they are responsible for their areas. I want them to be creative and innovative. And I've been very frank with them that we're going to make mistakes because we're going to take a lot of risks. What will be important when we make those mistakes is that we dissect them and we learn from them. But I certainly am not going to have, you know, this structure where people don't feel like they have the creativity to go out and seek the best way to do our work. So it's been wonderful seeing folks kind of blossom and really seeing some creative ideas and innovative ideas come through. And I'll share a little bit about how we're going to do more of that in these next couple slides. So obviously COVID was a big part of, you know, all of our operations, not only for DYS, but all state agencies. When I got here in December, we're still kind of dealing with that Omicron variant. So there was a lot of work that was done before I came to the agency on some prevention and intervention strategies. Even today, we are continuing with vaccine clinics. In fact, we have a vaccine clinic that will include the opportunity for families to come into our facility starting next week to get vaccinated. Mandatory testing was put in place for all staff members that are not vaccinated, so they get tested weekly. Currently with COVID-19, though, and the downcline that we've seen with infections across the state, we've certainly recognized that in the department as well. So we don't have any kids at all that are COVID positive at this time. We don't have any staff off for any COVID related reasons. So we're excited that the prevention and intervention strategies have helped. I feel like that's contributed to not only our community within our facilities, but certainly the broader community here in the state of Ohio. The workforce and vacancy rate certainly was impacted by COVID. We continue to deal with that today. Not only is the vacancy rate, you know, connected to kind of this great resignation and people feeling like they want to do their work differently, but it's also contributing to with more of our professional staff that there's a lot of different agencies vying for the same type of professionals. So we have had folks jump ship. But we've also had folks jump other agency ships to come to our ship. So it's just something that we're all continuing to deal with. And I am hopeful that our vacancy rate as it relates to our direct care staff has reduced. We started about 90 days ago, or actually just about 60 days ago, we had 122 vacancies for our direct care staff. And we're just down to 40 now. So about 2/3 of those, we've got staff that have come on board and been trained. But what I also learned in doing some evaluation of kind of our training and our retention is that during COVID, we kind of went away from our traditional training academy. So where our staff before COVID would come to our training academy and they'd be there for 3 weeks and really get intensive training to prepare them for their work, that couldn't happen because of COVID. We weren't bringing people from all over the state to one area for 3 weeks at a time because it just was too dangerous to do that with the risk of spread. So a lot of the training that our staff through COVID experienced in preparation for their job was through a Teams call or a Zoom call like this. And that's not a good way to prepare people for the work they do inside our facility. So that had a significant impact on our training and our outcomes, and certainly an impact on our retention. So we are happy to announce that we're doing our pre-service training back to the way we did before COVID in April. So April 11th will be the first class back at our academy for 3 weeks. We look forward to that. Also, during first 90 days, I spent a lot of time going out and meeting with our judges, our juvenile judges. We've got a lot of new judges in the state. I have had just a tremendous just support that has come from our judges. All of them, I think, who knew me before I left the department knew that, you know, I kind of grew up on the other side of the house. I was in the facilities and operations, and I have to tell you, the, you know, coming into this job, I knew that I did not know hardly anything about courts and communities and the work, the good work that's being done both with DYS and our partners in our courts and communities. And so it's been wonderful to have the judges educate me. I've gotten to go to many courts and spend the day and really see the good work that's being done. So I've enjoyed that, and I'll continue to do that, as I know that that's probably the biggest area for me that I want to really understand and see how the department can continue to grow in those areas. Partnering with law enforcement has also been important. I not too long ago met with the director of public safety here in Franklin County. Just to try to make sure that he knows that we want to be partners with him, as we have an increase in juvenile crime in this community. We're seeing the same thing in some of our other larger communities in Cleveland and Cincinnati. So there are plans in this next 90 days to meet with those law enforcement partners up there as well. I've also worked with some of the county prosecutors and trying to better understand some of their challenges as they deal with juvenile crime in their areas. So I look forward to continuing the community partnership with our law enforcement folks. Meeting with legislators was also been a really important part of these first 90 days, and I've enjoyed that as well. I've got a significant amount of insight into those that have a juvenile focus and what they'd like to see. I've had great conversations with Senator Manning on multiple occasions, as well as Senator Fetter, who has a heart, as you guys all know, probably for human trafficking and how we can enhance those efforts with our kids, particularly our female population at DYS. And then last week, I had the pleasure to finally meet in person with our juvenile justice advocates. I've made some contacts and tried to start building relationships with them when I first got back to DYS. And some of those were just a reintroduction, and looking forward to meeting with them. And some of those advocates were folks I hadn't met before. But another wonderful group that I think we will be able to partner with to really push some important agenda and initiatives that I think overall will help the kids in Ohio, both those that get diverted from DYS and then those that are reentering the community once they've spent some time in DYS. And the next slide is just, you know, talking really quickly about the evaluation and assessment about facility safety. I learned really quickly when I got here that there had been a survey regarding PREA, which is a Prison Rape Elimination Act. The Bureau of Justice and Statistics come in about every I think 7 or 8 years to do a survey. They had done a survey on the kids in DYS facilities in 2016. The report came out in 2018, and Circleville facility was mentioned as in the report as being a one of the highest for sexual misconduct in the country. And certainly there was some additional concerns that came from that report. Now, our kids don't spend more than, you know, typically about 17, 18 months with DYS, and it was even shorter time frame back in 2016. So a lot of what they found isn't really representative of the population we have now, but that doesn't mean that some of those same issues still don't exist. So I you know, immediately wanted to see what the response to that plan or what that survey came out, that, you know, the outcome of that report, what did DYS do? So there was a very specific strategic plan that was developed, and some efforts that took place right away. Some of that included an increase in cameras and eliminating blind spots where kids could be engaged in inappropriate behavior, areas where kids could inappropriately try to make contact with staff. So those cameras were very helpful. We revised our initial assessment that we do on intake for kids so that we can identify more appropriately kids that are potentially risk to be victimized in our facilities, as well as kids that have more of a predatory nature. So the revised vulnerability assessment that we do at intake was implemented. We also did some additional training. We've ramped our training both for staff and for students, and gained a lot of information just talking with students and surveying them on what things contribute to them feeling unsafe in our environment. So a lot came from that PREA survey. We've got a contract now with the University of Cincinnati. What we've asked them to do is kind of replicate that BJS survey that's done every 8 years. And we're looking, they're working on doing that now. And then we're going to implement that survey to our DYS kids again in this fall to see what those outcomes are and to see if the things that the administration put in place in 2018 has had a positive impact on our kids and in the, you know, feeling safer when it comes to their sexual safety. So I look forward to putting that in place and not waiting until the Bureau of Justice and Statistics comes back 8 years later. I wanted to really get some insight into how kids and staff are feeling right now. From a separation standpoint, separation, if you're not aware, is the it's a new seclusion term that's being adopted nationwide. They're getting away from the terms of separation and isolation with juveniles and going to the separation term. There are new standards with the American Correctional Association that will be coming out regarding separation standards. And of course, all of our facilities are ACA accredited, so they'll be in line with those new standards. But from a separation standpoint, what I saw very quickly when I did an evaluation of our separation hours is that over the course of the last year and year and a half, there was a significant number of hours that were dedicated to kids that were isolated or quarantined because of COVID. So it will be interesting now that we're coming out of that to see some significant hours go down and getting back into just some normalcy in our environments. And I'll talk more about that here in a minute. From an act of violence standpoint, what I've learned just in those first 90 days is that there hasn't been a real process of assessing when an act of violence occurs in our facility. It's almost like there's just been this lack of kind of dissecting each particular incident. Every incident is different, but there's a reason and a root for cause of why kids are engaging in assaultive behavior towards each other or towards our staff. So we're putting in place in these upcoming 90 days a specific process for how those will be reviewed, really looking to see what precipitating factors may have led to that incident. Staff will sometimes talk about what happens in the immediacy of an incident, but don't always go back and look at, did we miss something that may have been very obvious? So that'll be a part of our upcoming process. From a treatment and programming standpoint, there is a significant number of kids and staff that haven't operated outside of kind of our COVID mentality. With COVID was rampant, we had very small groups of cohorts that weren't interacting with anybody else. They stayed in their small cohort. There was not a lot of programming. We didn't have volunteers coming in, delivering programming. We didn't have groups traditionally like we would. Everything was done virtually with our kids. And you just can't reach kids that way. And I'm a believer that in order to have influence, you've got to be up close and personal to people. That's certainly true for the population that we serve. I think at times some of my colleagues in other state agencies, why doesn't DYS take advantage of telehealth with kids? Because it just doesn't have good outcomes in these settings. Kids have to be connected with adults. They have to be connected, in close proximity to really have the impact. So as we, now embark on returning to some normalized operations, we are going to be challenged with how our staff respond to that, having never experienced kind of normal pre-COVID operations because we've had such significant turnover, and also the expectations of our kids and how they will act and respond when they have access to other kids and other activities and other opportunities throughout the facility. So we have to certainly be mindful and planful as we start working towards a more normalized environment. But I'm looking forward to getting away from some of this kind of restricted and oppressed kind of processes to more open and normalized processes that I know are effective and will produce some successful outcomes. In the upcoming 180 days that as it relates to facility safety, I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, one of our guiding principles will be having a very trauma responsive environment. In doing that, you know, it'll be a safer environment for our staff and our kids. We're going to be looking at the point of intake, that there will be very specific pathways for each youth as it relates to their education and how they'll be preparing on day one for reentry. So, you know, kids will essentially be in an employment path. You know, if they're kids that are already graduates, they'll have an education path. And some kids will have a career tech and vocational path. So I'm looking forward to that being developed more precisely for each of our kids as they come in. Our evidence-based treatment, ART, SPARCS, which is structural psychotherapy for adolescents responding to chronic stress, you know, and looking at more evidence-based treatment to bring into our facilities. I think for some of the evidence-based treatment that we're doing now was probably cutting edge when we were going through reform, but we've been out of reform for 4.5 years now, maybe 5.5 years. So I'm sure that there is new and innovative practices that are out there that, you know, I want to bring back to the agency. So we'll be looking at that more closely in these upcoming months. Education, innovative curriculum delivery. I talked about that earlier. There's just so many things that we can do to bring innovation back into the classroom. And I'll be, you know, really honest with you. We have, you know, every kid in our facilities now has a tablet that they do education curriculum on, along with our teachers. So it's wonderful to have kids have tablets and have exposure to technology, which they respond to very well, and being able to tie that to both treatment and education curriculum. Our volunteers returned to our facilities last week. We're looking forward to all the work that they do with us, to partner with us, to bring really innovative programming, fun programming to our kids. So that's just another element of getting back to some normalcy. And then assessing our systems of incentives, rewards, and accountability. I really want us to work and tie more incentives to program completion, education goals that each individual kids, and how do we work that into our reward system. So there'll be some efforts to do that in these upcoming months. For community re-engagement and re-entry in these upcoming months, we're really working on workforce development. We have one stops in all of our shop, and there have been some barriers to our one stop shops. So, you know, our re-entry deputy director is working on removing those barriers. For sure, we have opportunities to partner now with some of our community employers. There is such a need, as you guys know, for the workforce outside of, you know, just our facilities. So being able to make sure that we're preparing our kids for that and setting them up for some success, but also setting them up to maybe have jobs that don't just include McDonald's or Arby's or Burger King, but preparing them through some credentialing where they can go into some other jobs. And we've been working with the Mean Ohio and the Workforce Development Office to look at those jobs that just require a high school diploma, but what jobs, you know, are out there that maybe pay a little bit more and require a little bit more skill development, and making sure that we have opportunities to credential those kids. So that workforce development one stops will be really enhanced in these upcoming months. Also, comprehensive case management employment project. We're looking at how we can continue to partner with some employers in the community. Our OOD partnership is really going to be expanded. We've already started exploring together, you know, what we can do with that agency. And then we're going to expand, or at least attempt to expand, on the Cuyahoga County Mentoring Program and see how we can put that in some of our other bigger cities that our youth are returning to. So a lot of work for reentry, and quite frankly, you know, the reentry division kind of came on board during COVID. So they have been really kind of, you know, kind of sidelined because of what was going on in the state with COVID. So I'm looking forward to them getting back in the community, getting engaged, and getting our kids ready to have some successful reentry. I also think with Ohio Rise coming on board, it will be an additional partnership that we can build on. One of the things we have that we have in the works right now, I've been working with State Director over Medicaid, Maureen Corcoran, because in DRC, we've got this age group of 18 to 21-year-olds that, when they get released, are released with full Medicaid. For the DYS population of 18 to 21-year-olds, they can't get Medicaid before they get released. And what that does then is it produces this gap of time where kids get connected to services in the community. Sometimes there's a gap in when they can get their medication. So we're working with the Medicaid agency to see how we can replicate what they do for 18 to 21-year-old adults in DRC with our kids, so that we can close those gaps, have that Medicaid in place as soon as they release, so those gaps can be eliminated. So I look forward to seeing how that progresses. Moving on to parole, this is probably the one area I focused on when I first got here, because there was a tragic incident that involved a kid that was whereabouts unknown, who was killed here in Franklin County. And it really made me dig into where we were from a leadership perspective in that area, what work was being done to produce, you know, sound supervision even through COVID, and what did that look like. And what we found is that frankly, you know, that division was just off mission as it relates to how they supervise kids and the importance of them having good supervision when kids are on parole. They also struggled with just having some consistency in the standards that were expected. From a whereabouts unknown standpoint, those are kids that are on parole that then, you know, just kind of disappear on us, and our parole staff lose contact with them. That whereabouts unknown list was the highest it had ever been in DYS. So we've got that down to the lowest it's ever been, just in 90 days, but there's certainly more work to be done in that area. And I'll talk about that here in a moment. And then with Reclaim, you know, kind of from its pilot, Reclaim was, has been studied about every 10 years since the inception of it. And, you know, we hadn't planned on doing, you know, any evaluation of Reclaim until, you know, recently. There were kind of some questions that came up about Reclaim and, you know, how is it impacting, or is it impacting public safety in a positive way? So in February, we had a Reclaim Advisory Board meeting where I asked the board for permission to do a study to see if there would be any value in assessing a change in the public safety beds, more specifically kids that commit aggravated robbery, aggravated burglary. What would that look like if we you know, worked on some change in legislation? How would that impact us? How would that impact the community? What would be the unintended consequences of that? So the committee did agree to allow us to do a quick study on those particular areas as it relates to public safety. And we're expecting, we've partnered with a university here, and we're going to be finalizing a contract with them. But the scope really will be looking at the impact of public safety and how some, you know, potential legislative action might be needed in the future if we move forward with some with whatever the outcome of that study is. So we look forward to hearing more about that. But we, you know, the hope is that we get started in April on that study, and that we'll have a report back this fall. Moving forward in the parole and community area, we are going to be developing system of incentives and rewards and accountability for kids on parole. This is new for DYS. Just like we have a behavior management system for kids in facilities, we're going to develop one for kids on parole. So as kids are going to programming like they should be and checking in and being in school like they should be or being at their job, there will be an incentive and a reward system set up for those kids. And then if kids aren't doing those things, there'll be some accountability as well. So we look forward to the development of that. The Community Intervention and Intelligence Unit, this is a proposal at this time. This time we're going to be requesting some ARPA funds for this particular unit. This will be a small unit that'll be first and foremost, a primary mission for this unit will be helping prevent youth from disengaging on parole. This unit will be really focused on those whereabouts unknown kids. They're going to wake up every morning with a focus on the kids that we've lost contact with. How do we get contact back with them? They're going to be partnering with law enforcement. They'll be partnering with some of the intelligence units that we have across the state. They will receive specific training. They'll be OPATA trained. They'll be able to enforce warrants where they haven't done that in the past. Like I said, this will be a very small unit of staff that will be highly trained and will be focused on preventing kids from going, disengaging from parole, going whereabouts unknown. Kind of their second mission is going to be with the rapid recovery of kids who do disconnect before they either commit a new victim or become a victim themselves. So I look forward to seeing if we can get the approval of this, the funding for this. We'll be, like I said, we'll be applying for ARPA funding probably first or second week of April as soon as those funds are released. Also working on fostering relationships with community partners, just kind of some common sense revisions to policy that focusing on upskilling our kids' skills as well as the families, not just going through checking a box on how we do our work, but really focusing in on the needs of families and kids when they're on parole. A big part of this work is to deepen our connections with those social ecosystems across the state, with education, with behavior health, with recreation, medical, child welfare. And as you guys know, we have, kids that are multi-system kids that are going back into the community. So just making sure that we have solid supports in place as they reenter and go back out on parole. And then focusing on our training, other initiatives like Ohio RISE and the Family First Prevention Acts are investing in strong communities and just like we are. So just looking at new approaches and utilizing technology, how we can help our staff and our kids grow and the effectiveness of how we do our work from a supervision standpoint once kids have reentered the community. Thank you. Finally, I think most state agencies have kind of worked their way back into the office. We are officially returning to the office on April 18th as our central office staff. We have a small percentage of people that will continue to work in a hybrid state. Most of those folks do a lot of work in our facilities and in our regions. So instead of if they're not traveling, requiring them to come here and occupy an office, we're going to permit them to continue the work that they do. Within this hybrid model where they can also work from home. And then we have a even smaller group of people. I think maybe less than 3% of our staff will be in a full telework mode. Most of those staff are IT folks that won't need to return to the office. And then everybody else will be in a full hybrid mode here in central office where they at least 3 days a week will be here in the office. And then 2 days of work will 2 days a week will work from home. So there's a lot of staff I haven't met yet other than through Teams. So I'm looking forward to people back being back in the office. Again, I feel like the best influence I can have on folks and from a leadership standpoint is being in close proximity to them. So I look forward to people being back in the hallways and in the office. So I can be firsthand involved in some of the good work that's going to be done here in the agency. So outside of that, guys, that's a lot, maybe more than what you had wanted and expected, but I certainly wanted to give you a framework of what we've been doing the first 90 days and what we'll be focusing on you know, with facility and community safety as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Oh, go ahead, Judge Fregali.
I'm sorry, Judge Salvaggio. Director, first of all, I'd like to welcome you, I guess, back to the Department of Youth Services.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to meeting you in person. Hopefully that'll occur sometime in the near future. As you're probably aware, Judge Delameter and I are part of a group of juvenile judges with CBCFs in our communities that we'd like to meet with your staff and you regarding staffing issues we're having at our facilities and the salaries associated with that. You've presented a really aggressive agenda this morning and the information is very good. I would like if we could get a copy of your PowerPoint, that would also be great. The one question I have is, are your CBCS falling under the courts and community section under Jordan Argus? Is he going to be the one that heads up that sections as far as who we contact and setting up our meetings?
Yeah, Jordan is, and thank you for the welcome. I appreciate that. Jordan will be the deputy director. Now, I think that the bureau chiefs are still in place. So the folks that you have normally worked with, whether that's Jody or Jim Hearns or Tony Panzino, those folks will remain in place and have been a wonderful help to me as I'm learning more and more about the work that we do in the community. So nothing will change in terms of those bureau chiefs who are probably the first line of contact, but certainly keep Jordan in the loop. If we are able to set up a meeting with you and Judge Delameter, then I'll certainly bring Jordan with me so he stays in the loop. I know I've had multiple conversations with different judges. Most recently, Amy in Greene County had a conversation with her. Same thing, you know, that you guys are dealing with is really similar to what we're dealing with in terms of workforce. And oftentimes I find that, you know, your CCFs might have a particular level of funding and salary for your staff. And then right down the road, the detention center is increasing, you know, their pay for their staff. So you're losing staff because they're going to the detention center. So I know there's a lot of dynamics to work through. Certainly, however we can help, I want to. But I can't help until I know kind of what the some of the problems are. So we'll get something set up right away. I'd love to come out your way and meet you both. I think Judge Delameter participated in our Reclaim Advisory Board meeting and had some really good things, good comments I thought were helpful after the presentations. And there were a few things I asked my staff to follow up with him on that he mentioned. So I look forward to it, you know, Judge, and we'll get something set up right away.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
And any Sarah, other comments?
I think Sarah said that they would post the presentation on their website. Is that right, Sarah?
Yes. And I've sent it to be posted, but in the meantime, Judge Fregali, I can send it to everyone today because I'm not sure what the delay will be. So we'll get it to you.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for the director?
Thank you so much, everybody. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Director. We're going to next turn to uniform sentencing entry and the sentencing data platform and turn it over to Hazim and Sarah and Jean.
Thank you. There's Hazim. Misty, I think. But in the meantime.
There he is.
Okay, good. So Hazim, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Sarah. And good morning, Judge Salvaggio and members of the commission. I'm honored to come before you to share the progress of the roadmap to launch the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform. As you may recall, the project recognized from the first day the complexities and challenges associated with this undertaking. At the same time, the project recognized that the citizens of our great state yearn for data-informed analysis, opinions, and decisions. The project aims at empowering judges with up-to-date and accurate templates that provide efficient and speedy generation of their entries while accurately describing the circumstances that influenced the decision. The complexities lie on one side in recognizing the uniqueness of the defendant, the case, the county, and the judge, while also recognizing on the other side the similarities of the circumstances that surrounds the defendant, the case, the county, and the judge. Navigating these uncharted complexities, successfully informed few principles that the project adhered to. The first is to recognize that there are unknown complexities and to implement a continuous, not a one-time, learning process. The second is to allow the project to evolve and adjust as it continues to learn and be informed. To enable these principles, the project follows a slow and iterative process within a diverse and inclusive governance structure. The outcome promises to be a point of pride for everyone involved and for the citizens of our great state. Over the last 15 months, I had the opportunity and honor to meet one-on-one with 70 Common Pleas judges in 31 counties. These meetings lasted between 2 and 8 hours and included conversations with the judge, the staff, and when possible, the lawyers and prosecutors in the courtrooms. It included observations of hearings, plea hearings, sentencing hearings, ILC, probation violations, and everything on a docket day. I observed the staff working pre, during, and post hearing. I observed the judge preparing for the sentencing, discussing options, thinking through difficult cases, and adjusting their decisions during the hearing on both ends of the spectrum. I observed cases that resulted in exoneration, cases that were disposed to ILC, community control, drug treatments, jail, prison, and life. I observed cases of drug possession, drug trafficking, gun violence, rape, sex offenses, and robbery. I observed cases with 1 or 2 counts and cases with 70 to 80 counts. I observed drug courts, probation staff, facilities, and sheriff deputies. The judges gave me an opportunity to debrief with them, ask them about their decisions, ask them what they considered, why they considered it, and what could they have done in a different circumstance. The fact that I continue to learn something new in every visit is a testament to these complexities. The learning from these observations continue to inform the project roadmap, strategies, and goals. I want to thank the leadership of the commission and the project for their courage to evolve and adjust to the project as we learn and discover something new. In one visit, a judge referenced a statement about the project from a year ago. I noted that since then, the project has evolved multiple times. It is then when I recognized that this is a new approach. And I believe that it is the right approach for such complex and critical task. We are not dismissing the complexities or ignoring it. We are learning about it, understanding it, and incorporating it. One of the learnings is that the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform will be an ecosystem of portals or a system of systems. The entry generation portal, which I will show you today, will empower judges with accurate up-to-date templates and information to support data-informed insights and decisions. In addition, we are building an Ohio Criminal Offense Code portal that will provide software systems with an accurate, normalized version of the criminal code. Furthermore, a context-based and profile-based public portal will share insights and analysis of sentencing data. All these portals are informed and continue to be informed and guided by the continuous learning and evolution. I will share my screen now and share with you the entry generation portal. Judges and their staff will come to the entry generation portal in order to incorporate the circumstances of their case, who was involved in the case, the prosecutors, the attorney, the circumstances surrounding the defendant, the charges and the counts and their evolution through the case, as well as an array of templates that they can use as appropriate for their case. Each one of these modules contains several templates, and I'm pleased to share with you today that the entire package of the uniform sentence and method of conviction entries are now included and available to the judges and their courts. There are 26 judges that are piloting and giving us feedback to continue to evolve the system. And that number increases with every visit. The system now is on version 3.4. I was looking at this yesterday, and it occurred to me it has not been a year yet since we launched version 1. It came out May of 2021. So within this, you could see the impact of that learning. I emphasize this because generally projects will start with a fixed scope and be determined to get that scope done despite any other learnings or evolution. It was intentional that this project does not follow this approach. In addition, in this version, we started to include help through videos that judges and their staff can see to learn how to use and utilize the system. For insights, judges will be able to see in the entry generation portal information at different levels about the cases, their cases, and the cases in their county. We continue to work through this project. We have a roadmap, a multi-year roadmap, but I believe the momentum we have now and the relationship and trust with the judges and our commitment to continue to learn about the complexities and incorporate them will ensure the success of this project. Thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you today. Sarah.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Hazem? Okay. To supplement what he presented, we got to thinking about it, and as because we're consumed by this work almost, well, yes, every day, it comes naturally and routine to us. And so in your packet of materials today, we included a timeline of, I'd say, more significant events throughout this, as Hazem calls it, journey of the work. And you'll see we started in October of 2019 when the Uniform Sentencing Entry Ad Hoc Committee was convened. And it was, you know, not a month later that we knew that in order to move this forward, and this being a uniform sentencing entry template for judges that is up to date and current, we had to move beyond the paper and Word versions. So at the same time that we were working with the Uniform Sentencing Ad Hoc Committee, we were trying to figure out ways to make sure that the templates would not remain on a shelf somewhere and not be updated. And so you'll see how we've progressed and some of the, like I said, more notable events through that time. We took the timeline through March of this year. And you'll see that in February of last year, the governance board created or sanctioned a data policy governance work group. And that work group is really tasked with developing the policy and kind of the administrative rules of how these systems will work. They are the ones that kind of went through the draft rules of superintendents and all of these things. And part of that work, we are fortunate, and I know I've said it before, but I want to emphasize it, that our colleagues in Pennsylvania have been kind enough to provide their expertise and guidance kind of on a technical assistance basis. We consult with them regularly. In fact, my colleague there, Mark Bergstrom, who's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing, participates on that work group. And we just took a team to Pennsylvania last week to learn more about how their systems interact through the Administrative Office of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Allegheny County Probation, the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing, and some others. And so we document that in the timeline. That's kind of the last notable event, I think. But we're going to continue to update that because I think as commission members, we get together quarterly and now it's been by Zoom. So we don't have an opportunity really to do these sidebar conversations. And it may dawn on you, how did we get here? What are they talking about? And so we wanted to give you kind of a picture of how we got here and the events that led us here. So if you have any questions or you want more information about any particular topic or event on that timeline, please let me know. And as I mentioned, we'll continue to keep it going. So anytime one of us think, how did we get here? We can go back and remind ourselves. If there are not any questions, I'll turn it over to you, Judge Zamuda, for the governance board updates.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all again, and I look forward to seeing you in person in the not too distant future. And that includes even you, President James, don't call me Spanago Madison. Good to see you again. Anyway, as you know, I chair the governance board, and timing works out nicely because the governance board meets quarterly as well, and it meets the 1 month prior to the sentencing commission meeting. So we met, our last meeting was February 18th. And much of what Sarah just said, at least with respect to the members of the governance board saying, wait a minute, where are we again? Because it only meets on a quarterly basis. We have become particularly aware that the amount of time that the commission and its members, the staff of the Sentencing Commission, Sarah and her team, are devoting to this project isn't necessarily being recognized by all the governance board members or the commission members because of all of the other things in which those members were doing. So it's good to remind everyone of that. And that's exactly what we did at our last governance board meeting. And well, I'll try not to be duplicative. I don't think I will of what Hazem's excellent presentation and the fine points that Sarah has already made. But it's also worth reiterating the ground rules that really help inform why we are choosing and why we have chosen, and we've used the word iterative process. And that really is the best word to describe the approach that has to be taken in order to achieve what we believe will be the successful outcome with a completed project. And that is because it's iterative for this very reason. Every one of the site visits that Hazem has spoken about, and the efforts that we are employing to seek the input of the judges and the courts as it relates to adopting the platform and utilization of the templates is always done with the understanding that we are integrating into existing court practices. That can't be overemphasized. We're not dictating policy changes in how the courts operate, but rather using this platform and the templates within the existing practices within each of the various courts, which is why we go to every court and why we go to every judge of every court. And it's really encouraging to me that in less than a year's time, by the next time we meet, because I know Hazem has some additional judges scheduled first part of April, we'll have hit one half of the 88 counties. Hazem will have visited half of the counties of this state in less than a year's time, based on their interest, those particular judges' interest, and well over 80-some judges that he will have personally met. That tells you the interest that continues to grow as it relates to this particular project. So we're integrating with existing court practices, and it's incremental and slow so that we can adapt within the platform structure the individual practices to make sure that we can mesh what we're doing on our side with the current practices within the court system itself. The other thing that I think it's important, and we highlighted this at the governance board meeting, and so I'll share with you again, is Hazem just showed you what version 3.4 presently looks like. What he didn't say, and I'm going to tell you, is the import of what version 3 really does. Because certainly it looks different than version 1 and version 2, but what version 3 really does, it digitally will now permit the updating as timely as we have committed to performing in order so that this is that living document that every judge who utilizes the use, who implements their sentencing mechanism within the platform will never, ever have to worry about that entry being inconsistent with current law and current statutes. The pressure that every trial judge has to making sure they get the sentence right will have some relief that they don't have to worry about having the structure of the form incorrect and therefore in error. That can be overemphasized. The other thing that has happened that we highlighted in the governance board meeting that is worth noting here is the standardization that is happening also has occurred within the context of our organizational structure. I would encourage you to look at the website for the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform. It tells you, it can be used to supplement, quite frankly, the timeline that Sarah has prepared and shared with everyone. That website gives you all of the things that we are doing on a consistent and regular basis. And when you go to it, there's a section which is called the roadmap. And in the roadmap, we share with you what our phase looks like, what the phases of this project as we envision them occurring. And when you look at the current phase, right, which is the launch phase, we see 8 what we call lines of effort. So one of the things that we've accomplished, I think, is in going forward, we've standardized what those lines of effort are. Site visits, the OSDP operation, development, a public portal, offense code. These are the lines of efforts that we believe will proceed through each one of these phases until we have successfully completed the creation of this and utilization of this platform. And what that means, therefore, is that we can measure the success of how well we're doing or how poorly we're doing based on whether or not we're hitting our particular targets as it relates to those 8 lines. They're independent, but they're related to each other, and each line is necessary to be successfully completed in order for the project ultimately to have success. I think this will help, again, increase that transparency so people can see as they follow our journey, as they follow the journey of this project, the success with which we accomplished and the speed with which that accomplishment has occurred. The other aspect, which is really exciting to me, is one of the lines of efforts when you look at it is a line of effort which we call OSDP integration. And this really gets to the heart of how it's going to be ultimately successful for the state of Ohio. Because we know that data exists everywhere. And part of our effort is to identify what data is relevant, what information is relevant and necessary in order for that sentencing entry to be complete and accurate. And then what information is relevant and necessary that it's worth retaining for the study and analyzing and appreciating and evaluating the criminal justice system? Well, it starts with the use, but we know that within the criminal justice system, what I like calling the continuum from arrest to disposition or post-disposition, actually, there's a whole bunch of other points of data that doesn't have to be recreated, but merely needs to be accessed. And that's where the integration lies. And what is happening at this point is for the first time, we are about to engage in interacting and integrating with the Ohio Court Network, which the trial judges in this organization are familiar with. And that's the first integration that we're approaching and that we're attempting to have available. You heard Hazem discuss the offense code project. That offense code project, once that's fully up and running, and we anticipate that to occur within this calendar year, based on the trajectory that we've accomplished thus far and where we're headed, That would be another potential integration with other existing entities who will say, for the first time in Ohio, there's a digital format that will allow standardized Ohio offense code evaluation and that doesn't exist elsewhere. The offense codes that exist are presently hard copy and paper. And to have that digitized, the criminal code digitized, will increase the integration ability between the project, the various courts, and those entities within the criminal justice system that seek and utilize an offense code as part of the work that they perform. So you can see we've been busy. We also spent a great deal of time and really vibrant discussion as it relates to the parameters of the data governance policy, the work policy that Sarah referenced. We have a standing committee that is working on that. And we will continue to have that group work on the policy itself. We have our project team, which is attempting to figure out what specific elements of the various portals are worth capturing and collecting. And that's a collaborative and open process. And we've had some really robust and meaningful discussion, and we will continue to do that. And as we, the governance board, render decisions and approve policy, we will notify you accordingly. So one of the other things that has happened is the governance board had previously approved rules of superintendent to qualify the platform itself as coming under the rules of superintendent, and then carving out some exceptions as it relates to public records. We submitted the proposed language to the Commission on Rules of Superintendent, and those recommendations, which we had previously submitted to the Sentencing Commission, was approved by the Commission. And the normal process is from the Commission on the Rules of Superintendent, it then goes to the Supreme Court for their consideration. On March 8th of this year, the Ohio Supreme Court took up and considered the proposed rule changes to the rules of superintendent. Brian Schmenk, who is legal counsel that is assisting in the drafting of the language, did the actual presentation. Sarah Anders was there. I was invited, and so she and I were there to answer questions. A very, again, robust discussion amongst the justices, the upshot of which is that we have been invited back, and we will be returning to do something that we've done many times, including with this group, and that is we're going to give them a demonstration of how the platform and how the use works so that they can have a better visualization of what it is that we're trying to capture and the import of the necessity of having the rules of superintendent. We'll be doing that next week, and we anticipate they're acting upon the rules of superintendent, which would then go into public comment, so that process would then be employed. Sarah already mentioned the Pennsylvania trip that we just completed. This trip is really significant for two overreaching reasons as far as I, the first is this. What Pennsylvania is presently doing and what they have the capacity to do isn't quite our North Star, but it's close. Because they've been doing something in terms of the integration of data and the utilization of data for their criminal justice system since the 1980s. So it's nice to see the vibrancy on a fully developed system, what can occur, and the interactions between the various entities within the criminal justice system is remarkable. The speed with which, and therefore the efficiency with which, they're able to accomplish the individual assignments within the criminal justice system is also incredible. They even measure the time it takes between arrest and initial appearance. All of that's available and all of that's possible because they have this infrastructure that allows them to share information. And that's really the other point. So we have this long range vision of what can be accomplished. So we see that the mountain down the road, right? We see, or up on the hill, we see what can be accomplished. But what else we actually saw was the structure, maybe the path of how you can accomplish to get to that mountain. And that is something that they call JNet, which really is a shared information highway. You know, we have 88 counties, and each county has their information as it relates to their particular work. All right. And nobody wants to say you can't do it that way. But what we're really trying to create is a mechanism by which we can share each other's work. All right. Because we realize now that in 2022, the information, what happens in Claremont County, might be particularly relevant to what happens in Champaign County or Greene County or Lucas County. And there should be ways that would be more efficient for the sharing of that information. There is using technology. Pennsylvania has fully implemented it. We're looking at how can we accomplish such a thing, recognizing that we are not a unified state, recognizing the import, and I think appreciating the sanctity of the individual counties, but still the import with every county would want to, what will it take for each county to say, you know what, we should be sharing this information, not retaining it for ourselves. That's the short-term goal that we're headed toward. And I think we're going to be able to accomplish that. On the technical side, Dr. Saeed will probably tell you that he was particularly intrigued by the technical means by which they are able to accomplish it. And we'll be looking forward to certain recommendations and again, maybe nuances or modifications to what we're doing presently and going forward. Again, mindful of that iterative process. So I think that pretty much summarizes where we, what we've done with respect to the governance board and as well as the Pennsylvania Commission. Happy to answer any questions that any of you might have in light of my comments.
All right. Hearing none. So thank you, Judge Zamuda. And if there are no questions, we'll kind of move through the agenda. Will and Judge Zamuda, I don't see Reggie on. I think he must have had a conflict. And I'm wondering if we should give the House Bill 1 group some time to present and maybe preview this indeterminate sentencing for our next meeting. Would that be okay?
Well, I was going to say, Sarah, actually, as my good friend or our good friend Yogi Berra once said, deja vu all over again. Will and I began this presentation to the work group. We had insufficient time to complete it. I think we should defer, especially with, because I think we need Reg's comments to sort of set it up, and then we can do that maybe at the beginning of the next meeting. Yeah, by then we'll have fully provided it to the work group as well. And we might even have some recommendations coming from it in light of the discussion that I think it's going to generate. So,
yeah. And I'd invite anybody who's on today, if you're not participating on that roundtable work group, you're certainly more than welcome and invited to attend. Many of you are, but for those of you who are not and may have an interest in helping us with that work, we'd appreciate having you. So just let me know and I can give you all the meeting information and details. So thank you, Judge Zamuda. And so next on the agenda, I'm really happy to introduce Laura, who was gracious enough, as you all know, to chair our study impact, or I forget how it's phrased, but anyway, our House Bill 1 study of the impact. And I'm also, it reminds me right now too, that since our last meeting, I don't know that everybody realizes we had a promotion in the office. Nikki Hotchkiss is assistant director with the commission. She's done an outstanding job, obviously. So welcome her into that role. We're currently trying to fill her researcher position. She's been a great asset in that role. So I appreciate that. And congratulations again, Nikki. She was promoted in December. But she and Todd and Laura really guided the work of the work group. We produced the report and it's in your, the link is in your materials. It's a big document. So I would suggest maybe you think about it first before you download it, but do take a look at it. Thank you, Judge Savaggio. I knew you'd have a hard copy. but I'm going to turn it over to Laura, Nikki, and Todd.
Good morning, everybody. I apologize for the pause. I actually just took a call and just got back. So thank you, Sarah. And thank you to everybody that served on the committee that looked into the implementation of House Bill 1. I know that a report has been prepared by the committee, by the staff that worked with me on that committee, and I appreciate all the input that we got. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to them so they can talk about what we have found and what we've reported back.
Great. Thank you, Laura, and thank you so much for your assistance in leading the work group. I'm going to share my screen. We have a very short PowerPoint. All right. Is everyone able to see that? Okay. Just as a reminder, the commission was tasked with evaluating certain sections of House Bill 1. It was entered into revised code section 181.27B, and it highlighted specific changes to specific sections of the revised code that needed to be evaluated on a regular basis. So this report that Judge Salvaggio displayed was our first report, and then we will be doing it every 2 years after that. As was explained, we gathered a work group composed of judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, court administrators, probation officers, academics, and state agency officials to guide this effort. These sections cover areas from record sealing to intervention in lieu of conviction to involuntary commitment to treatment in probate court and technical incarceration on technical violations. So it's a broad area. We needed a lot of expertise and a lot of assistance, which we were lucky to receive. So the group met monthly, and the first few meetings were each dedicated to one of those main subject areas. And then remaining meetings discussed the status of data collection efforts and analysis, resolved any outstanding issues, and discussed the content of the report. And for each of these substantive areas, we discussed a number of questions as a group. So we talked about the intended outcomes of the legislation, and then what we needed to know, what information we needed to track down to know if these outcomes were achieved or how far these changes went in achieving these outcomes. We also outlined, if we were able, what information we'd want to know, and then what information would be nice to know. So there were sort of three different levels, the last one being more of a wish list if we were able to find a wealth of data. We also discussed as a group if there were any potential unintended consequences for this legislative change that we needed to be aware of. And as we were looking over our various data sources and talking with practitioners. And so in an effort to address these issues and gather the information, we employed a number of different methods, including reaching out to individual courts for their quantitative information, and then one-on-one interviews with practitioners, as well as focus groups. So this really was a collective effort. So we greatly appreciate all of the work group members and their time. And we also were lucky enough to have a good number of interns throughout this year that helped to supplement the report and did a lot of secondary research. So we were very lucky there. So the report is, as Sarah said, rather lengthy, but the main part really consists of recommendations about these four substantive areas: record sealing, ILC, involuntary commitment to treatment, and incarceration on technical violations and community control. And so we outlined what recommendations we had based on our efforts to evaluate the impact. And That was a bit of a challenge in both understanding how to define what the impact might be in each of these areas, as well as, as well as, really there wasn't a lot of time for this legislation to be implemented to see what the change was. So the changes in House Bill 1 were implemented in April of 2021, and the report was due at the end of December. So we're dealing with a small window of time. So that was also a little bit difficult to evaluate changes. So we were really focused on understanding what was happening and how things might change based on this statute. So briefly, the record sealing recommendations are based on information gathered from individual courts. We sent out a request to court administrators for information on motions to seal records. And we received a variety of information and not from many courts. Some courts contacted us and said, sorry, we don't have that information, or we don't have the staff that has the time to provide that information. Others were able to give us general numbers of this is how many we granted. Some were able to give us much more specific information about including denials and reason for denials. So we recommend a method for standardizing this collection of data to really understand if, the effort for expanding record sealing, we need to evaluate how, if more people are able to do this and more people are seeking it out, we need a standard way to measure this. So there are, in the report, there's a couple of different ideas for how this could happen. In our data collection, we also interviewed a group of legal aid attorneys and compared Ohio's changes in record sealing to other states' recent changes. So some other recommendations that are based on that work are to allow restricted access to anonymized data for research and evaluation purposes. Some courts reached out to us after our request, concerned that we were asking them to create a report that they would now have and would then be
looks like we have a little freeze going on. Oh, there she is.
We lost you for a minute there, Nikki.
Oh, sorry. We're okay.
Yeah, Todd, maybe you should take over if you can.
Sure. Yeah. I'll take over until Nikki might get back with us. So essentially, Nikki was describing, let me share my screen.
Sorry.
Oh, she's back. Nikki, do you want to reshare your screen or would you like me to jump to mine?
If you wouldn't mind jumping to yours, just sure. It may be more reliable.
Okay.
So I was talking about restricted access to anonymized data for research and evaluation purposes. Did you all hear that portion?
No. Well, no. We didn't hear the description of that. So
okay. Some of the courts expressed concern that we were asking them to create a report of record sealing requests and those, including those that were granted. And then that report would then be accessible for public access requests. And so we want to make sure that there is a way to be able to evaluate if numbers of motions for record sealing without courts being worried about divulging this information and therefore, defeating the purpose of record sealing. So that was a very specific recommendation that came out of some of our conversations. The third is overall to simplify the process. For example, clarifying what a final discharge includes. Some practitioners told us that some judges and courts included completing payment of restitution. Others considered an end to supervision, the final discharge. And then in other states, there's an automatic sealing of non-convictions that was suggested to simplify the record sealing process. And the fourth recommendation is to expand educational efforts to inform about the eligibility requirements to prevent those that are not eligible either for time or other reasons for submitting and kind of creating more work for the system, and also educating those that are eligible to be able to take advantage of these opportunities.
Nikki, can I jump in? And sure, I wanted to add one thing about the restricted access to sealed records. I just wanted to plug our work again on the data governance policy work group as part of the OSDP is actually working on that issue of, how do we maintain sealed records in the actual database? And that's another area where we've looked to the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing, which actually has a policy of retaining anonymized aggregate sealed records internally for research purposes. So they're able to go back and say, in 2018, we had X number of sealed records and answer some policy questions on that. So as part of our work, developing a governance policy, we're looking at best practices in the state and other model states to allow for looking at sealed records for research and policy purposes.
Thank you. Involuntary commitment to treatment recommendations. This was challenging because it is in the very much outside of our realm of expertise to the probate courts. And we got a lot of assistance through treatment providers, probate judges, that really helped increase our understanding of this program and how we might evaluate it. This practice was originally put into statute in 2013, and anecdotally from the people that we talked to, it's been used only a handful of times, maybe 10 to 15 times in the entire state in that amount of time. And the changes that happened with HB1, we're really interested to see if that increases utilization of involuntary commitment to treatment. So we suggest, again, a method of standardized data collection, an easy way, well, I don't know how easy, but a way to do this might be to include this specific case type on the probate case management forms. Currently it's included and wrapped up in another case type. So separating that out would allow us to monitor use. Second was to explore options to make treatment available regardless of financial or insurance status. Virtually everyone we talked with highlighted the financial barrier to utilization of this provision. This says that the petitioner, if they go to the probate court and petition to have a loved one committed for treatment, they have to prove that they have the financial ability to pay for the treatment, or that they have the insurance that will pay for the treatment. And so many people that we talked to highlighted that as one of the major reasons that this is not utilized very often. And then third is simply educating and informing families that this kind of non-criminal justice option exists. And fourth, to expand educational efforts to inform judges of changes to the statute. Some people that we talked to were not aware of the changes to allow proof of insurance to work as a financial financial evidence. So to educate practitioners about these changes as well. And I'll turn it over to Todd.
All right, thank you, Nikki. So our study of intervention in lieu of conviction was one of the bigger pieces of our HB1 report. And let me start with the first recommendation, which is advancing better data collection on ILC and outcomes. I'll tell you can see in the report, we requested data on ILC from 122 courts and received data on it from 9 courts. So that's less than a 10% response rate on that data. And we started the project not knowing how many people were even on ILC statewide, and we ended the project still not knowing that. So we got the data from the 9 courts. We also got data from DRC with their 18 APA counties. So it's really difficult to monitor and evaluate the impact of legislative changes when we don't really have a baseline and we still don't have that great data on that. So certainly that'll be a big part of our efforts with the sentencing data platform. But we also in the report wanted to emphasize, it seems like a handful of courts that we were able to get into contact with are actually doing some sort of programmatic monitoring and evaluation. The second recommendation that came out of our work was better communicate House Bill 1 changes regarding ILC. So because of the lack of quantitative data, part of this project, we actually talked to judges, probation officers, court administrators, prosecutors, and defense attorneys in these in-depth, sometimes hour-long or more interviews, asking them what they were seeing in regards to ILC as it relates to House Bill 1. And one of the things that came out of those conversations was that, especially at the municipal level, a lot of attorneys were not even aware of the changes that were made in this legislation. In fact, some of them weren't even aware of the changes made in the 2018 expansion of ILC, which allowed or which took away the caps for using ILC. So one of the municipal court magistrates we talked to actually said, you know, defense attorneys were advising their clients, don't waste your ILC at the municipal level, when in fact, you know, that advice was no longer relevant. So, you know, one of the recommendations we wanted to hit on was making sure everyone at the common pleas and municipal level, defense bar prosecutors understood where what the statute was actually changing. Another big thing that came out of those conversations we had was streamlining the statute to make it simpler and less confusing. So with the latest statute sort of aiming to expand ILC and mandate that judges give written entries explaining why ILC was denied, a lot of the folks we talked to said, with all these changes to ILC, we're not really sure who makes a good candidate for it. You know, what, you know, how is this program supposed to be run, essentially? So we didn't come to consensus on specific statutory language, but certainly a lot of people were wanted to see some streamlining and simplification addressing who makes a good candidate for ILC. And finally, a huge issue we came across, and a special thanks to Judge Salvaggio, who talked to us a lot about the treatment side of ILC evaluations. So this is kind of a two-part issue. One, the cost of ILC. So some courts actually receive a lot of funding through DRC and other state programs to run their ILC program. So cost isn't an issue for them. It's also not an issue for a defendant. But in other jurisdictions, they're not receiving that funding, or maybe they're using their funding for alternative diversionary programs. So they actually aren't running an ILC program because of prohibitive costs. And one issue with this was the costs of actually getting an evaluation from an accredited treatment provider. There's no standardization to those costs. There's also no standardization to the actual reports provided to the judges in probation when someone requested an ILC evaluation from a treatment provider. So we spoke to some judges who are getting very detailed, 50-page reports. This is what the defendant needs, and this is what kind of programming they should get. And some of the reports were only a couple sentences long, and it was essentially not very useful for the judges. So those are our core recommendations. Sort of simplifying the statute, looking at some standardization of what the treatment providers are actually doing for the ILC program. And finally, better communicating those changes so ILC is not a moving target for people. As the statute, it seems to be updating every couple of years now. Our final area of study for House Bill 1 was technical violations and community control recommendations. So House Bill 1 attempted to provide a standard definition for technical violations while in community control. Unfortunately, this definition was revised, I think it was in June, sometime over the summer after House Bill 1, which changed the language of technical violations again. So we weren't able to provide any analysis on this because it was such a moving target with the definition changing. But we did speak to Brian Martin at the Department of Rehabilitation Corrections, and he estimated that this definition change would be affecting about 100 people at ODRC. And he expressed they'll be monitoring the levels of churn. So it's difficult for them to provide, rehabilitative programming if somebody is in and out of the prison system. So they'll be monitoring churn and whether this number is increasing or decreasing. But again, in talking to people in our work group meetings, there was once again a desire to work towards simplification of this definition and making it more meaningful. So I'll end there so we can take questions or comments.
Easy group today.
Well, I would just like to thank the staff. I'm sorry, Judge Del Faggio. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I had a chance to read the report, and I thought you guys did a nice job. I thought that you accurately reflected the work that I participated in, particularly with regard to ILC. And then I thought that the report also accurately reflected some of the challenges that we have in administering those portions of the law that affect our work. And I look forward to the follow-up to this, because it'll help us provide a nice look back as to, were we on the right path, and was this material that we collected useful in trying to solve some of our problems? And, just as an example, the idea of how to deal with an OVI and an ILC offender, and some of the issues that were raised by that fact pattern didn't make it out of legislative committee. And so, how will legislators now use this information to, forecast their next move? So good job, in my opinion.
I was going to say the same thing. The staff worked very, very hard. And I think, as they pointed out during the presentation here today, one of the biggest difficulties was even finding the data to look at in order to provide a sense for how this might impact the courts going forward. And so I think that is probably the biggest takeaway from this study over the past year. And I think in 2 years, to the extent that we might have additional data, that would be incredibly useful. But if there's anything to take away from this, it's just the common drum that we've been beating all morning and all the last number of years of data simply not being available in order to adequately assess some of these legislative changes.
Can I just continue to express my concern that we as a criminal justice system have not done a good job from the legislative side, the judicial side, and the maybe even the treatment side as to how to apply the intervention in lieu of conviction statute. And I think part of that is because we all have differing opinions as to what is the purpose of the ILC statute. And until we as a system get a handle on how we want to treat relapse and how relapse can evolve into complicating other factors that may be at issue with what some may think the purpose of the ILC statute is for, we're going to continue to have inconsistent application across the state. And so, you know, one of the things that I would encourage, whether it's this group or another group, to look at is really defining what is the purpose of ILC. We know that ILC is to be considered whenever substance abuse or mental illness contributes to committing criminal offense. But what role do we want ILC to play? And, you know, I define it as a statutory diversion program. And if that is accurate, I mean, if that's an accurate interpretation of what ILC is supposed to be, then it helps guide me as to, well, how much tolerance do I have for new behavior that should not be diverted from the intent of the intervention plan. And so I see that as the primary problem that we currently have with ILC.
Yeah. If I could, Beth Capelli, I think you have a similar issue with ceilings, to be honest with you. What is the purpose behind a ceiling anymore? You know, somebody made a mistake. Okay, maybe they were young and stupid and made a couple mistakes. And I think that judges are not applying it correctly sometimes. I know I've had people come in front of me who I'm denying a ceiling, and they've said, well, I just went to such and such court and they granted it. So there might be some more education that's needed in ceilings. I know we do it at our muni judges, but it seems like there's an issue with that still, just to let you know.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no other comments, Laura, thank you and your group very much for the work you did.
They made it very easy. I just had to show up on time.
So the last thing that we have before adjourning is Sarah and I have discovered that we have a conflict, or there are some conflicts with having the June 24th scheduled meeting. And so, Sarah, I'm going to ask you to lead the discussion on how we want to resolve this.
You know, June always is a debacle for us. The Common Pleas Judges Association summer conference is usually around the third Thursday of the month, and then during a budget year, it's, you know, legislators and budget stuff. So we moved it this year to the 24th, but that's also a conflict. So I would throw out there, how about we meet the third Thursday in July? And I know it's summer vacations and all that stuff, but at least it's a third Thursday. It's more, you know, back to a routine. So that would be July 21st. And so we would do a July meeting instead of June. Does anybody have, I mean, I know you may have vacation, but is that agreeable for the most everyone? Judge Spanigal, it's really nice to see your face. And you're muted. That just doesn't seem right.
Well, I'm here. I just sometimes turn the camera off, so I put the camera on. I love what you've done with your office at 65 South Front with the plants and the mirror. It's very nice.
It is very special. All right, so I'll update the meeting invitation, hearing no real pushback on the 21st of July, and look forward to seeing you all then, and maybe in person.
Hey, Sarah, just before you go, I would just remind you that the National Association of Counties, I believe, is the 20th through the 24th of July.
Okay. So maybe we'll need a Zoom option because you could do double duty, Commissioner.
That would be fine. I will attend from beautiful Denver.
Hey, that's not a bad place to be. All right. Thank you. So Judge Salaggio, back to you.
All right. Well, as we come upon the noon hour, are there any comments for the good of the order? Having seen none, then I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
So moved. So second.
We throw Judge Spanigal and Commissioner Painter as a tie. All right. Thank you very much. We'll see you later. Director Ask, thank you again for your presentation, and we look forward to seeing you here at our meetings regularly.
Thank you so much. It was an honor.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.